Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, before we get going, I want to tell you about our sponsor today. It's Squarespace. Squarespace makes it so easy to put up your portfolio or your blog or just show off your work. You don't need anything more than a mouse. It's all drag and drop, and it looks beautiful, totally customizable. Best part is you get a free domain. That's right, a free domain if you sign up. You go to squarespace.com. Put in offer code LONGFORM. You'll get 10% off your first purchase plus a free domain. Thank you, Squarespace. Here's the show. Hello and welcome to the LONGFORM podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer here with Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff.
Got a doozy for you guys.
What you got, Aaron?
This week on the show, we've got Al Baker, who is a crime reporter for the New York Times. He has a series out called Murder in the 4-0 that is tracking, or did track for a year, every homicide in a single precinct in the Bronx, which is itself, I believe, the poorest congressional district in America.
I am excited for this episode.
It's a fantastic interview. His father was a police officer. He became a crime reporter. He's been doing this for over 20 years and we could have kept the stories going all night from this interview.
Fantastic. If you wanted to
keep the stories going all night, sounds like an erotic fiction by email service. Look, if you want to keep the stories going all night and let other people in on these all-night stories that you're telling, you're going to need a MailChimp account. They allow a business, a project, a podcast, whatever, whoever you need to keep in touch with, to maintain an email list and send out to that email list without all the hassles. Thank you, MailChimp.
You have so many fans for your all-night stories, Aaron.
All-night story, the new season of All-Night Stories is going to be the best one ever.
And now here's Aaron with Al Baker.
Welcome, Al Baker.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I was just reviewing the series that you've been doing. It's been over a year now, the Murder in the 4-0.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, before we even get into it, tell me what your original concept for the project was.
We wanted to understand how murder happens in a time in New York City where crime is low, historically low. Every year there's a end-of-year news conference by the mayor and the police commissioner. For many, many years now, crime has gone down, and it's sort of gotten to a flat level of generally accepted low percentage of crime. And we wanted to understand, in those places in the city that haven't gone along for the improvements, what's happening there when one human being kills another? What are the forces driving? What propels one human being to be at that moment and die, and another to be at that moment and be an alleged killer? And to sort of get behind the daily stories that we've done for years into the lives of the people affected and to examine what was happening in terms of society, in terms of the public services that they received, whether it's public housing or, and most particularly the police, you know, what the police are doing to solve these things and what the obstacles are to pushing crime down in this kind of an area so it could be the same benefit, receive the same kind of safety that the rest of the city has. I mean, crime in the South Bronx has gone down tremendously,
right.
But it's not as low and not as safe, clearly, as other places in the city.
When did you start out as a reporter?
A long time ago. I've been doing this a long time. I got out of college in 1989, and I've been doing it ever since.
So you actually reported on a truly more crime-filled city, a city that had a legitimately much higher crime rate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember I was a Daily News reporter for the New York Daily News from 1993 to 96, covering police, and we would go each day review what happened on the overnight. And yeah. In those days, they were handwritten reports that the police gave out called the sheets. And we would look at them, and there was typically five or six or seven murders each morning. And we certainly couldn't cover all of them. We would look through them, and we would decide which one should we try to tackle, which one was perhaps most surprising or most compelling. And that's also part of what drove this series, because covering police and covering disorder, covering tragedy for so long, there's a language that the police use, and there are code words that perp and priors, and those color your first analysis of a death.
Right.
And color them in ways that, you know, we want to get behind.
Right. When I've read about crime in America, you generally read one of two types of stories. You read about the huge macro story of crime in America, which is basically, is crime up or down? Which is almost always a political issue in this country. And then a series like Murder in the 4-0 is the microest of micros. It's a single precinct, 1 year, 14 homicides. You have enough time and space to really look subtly and with detail into each victim and each perpetrator of each of those crimes. So I wonder how someone who does your job and has been doing it for 20 years, when basically the issue of is crime, you know, are we living in an American carnage or are we living in some of the safest times in human history comes up, how do you regard that question? How do you look at those macro crime statistics as a reporter? Do you look at them suspiciously or do you generally see them as accurate?
I wrote many of those macro stories for many years.
Yeah.
And there was a desire by reporters, by journalists, and myself. I was the police bureau chief for 8 or so years at the New York Times. And every year I would write an end-of-year crime story that told the macro story and tried to tell it in ways that were somewhat more enlightening for readers each year, focusing sometimes on the different phenomenons that that you could see from the macro statistics. And I'm very proud of that work. And I don't see having wasted my time. I think that that is, you know, somewhat of public service journalism and our contribution, you know, to the American experience, you know, to the New Yorkers' experience, to reflect as accurately and with as much integrity about the portrait of crime.
Yeah.
But the series really was, as I said, a desire to try to tell the micro story. Now, I think that it is true, it is undeniable that the level of violence and disorder in America writ large or in New York City is clearly down. You had in excess of 2,000 murders, 2,200 murders in 1990.
Yeah.
Now the annual numbers are 400, 300.
Yeah.
But I think that demands a greater, the receding tide of crime has allowed a greater inspection of the crime where it is happening, like Chicago or like this portion of New York City.
Yes.
And it's even more valuable to look at it. Some of these arguments politically are almost like straw men. You know, I saw something recently that was police aren't shooting wildly. There's the myth of the uncontrollable police shooter, because the level of police officers firing their guns in America is down.
Right.
Last year, there was something like 89, I believe, total discharges of firearms by police officers, 37 of which were in confrontations with other people in which they were facing someone with a gun. That's far lower than the 1970s. Look at the number of police officers killed. It's lower.
Right.
However, we need to examine the situations in which the officers do use force. The low levels of crime have allowed a closer examination in the cases where they are happening, and allowing us to explore things that structurally have not been able to be explored. We can start to examine the implicit bias that police officers may harbor and not know. We can begin to examine some of the historical roots of crime, structural racism, the policies that are applied in certain neighborhoods and not others. Michelle Alexander has written in the New Jim Crow about, you know, right, the war on drugs versus the heroin epidemic. One's a health crisis, one's a war. And so I think the aspirations for citizenry, for society, is to reach further levels of safety, and thus it's even more imperative to examine crime even at its lower points.
Yeah. I grew up in Berkeley, but it's adjacent to Oakland, which at the time was the murder capital of America in the 1980s. And when you look at a case like Oakland in the 80s, or modern day Chicago, or even on a more micro level, a single precinct in New York that is anomalously high, which you looked at in the Bronx with this series, where do you start looking into that story when you see the three precincts next to this one, or the three major cities that most resemble this city, have very different statistics and are really have solved the crime problem more effectively? Where does that story start for you?
You know, we went in covering murder, right, and it was really quite novel. We stated our purpose in the newspaper in the very first story,
yeah,
which was sobering. I mean, that's very rare in journalism. Usually you do an investigation, you find the truth in a certain area, and you report it.
Yeah.
But here we were saying, this was very organic, we're going to cover every time a murder, a homicide occurs, we're gonna write about it. And we didn't know if we would face a 2015 with one murder or 20.
Right.
We wound up, last year there were 9. We wound up with 14. So we learned as we went. And there's a lot of things informing our brains as we marched through the year. The first murder of Carmen Torres Gonzalez really exemplified the close-in living and the sort of crumbling infrastructure of public housing. The South Bronx has 14 high-rises, 14 public housing complexes. I think that's the first thing that sort of assaults your senses when you go there. They're almost like waves on the streets. They feel like waves. They feel like towering edifices, towers in which people live very closely together. And they are in many cases, we found, disrepair. So, and the other thing that hits you right away is a sense of isolation, that you can feel that the streets are very far away. You're in a courtyard, you're in another courtyard. It's kind of a cascading series of tunnels or something that you're walking into, and it's away from the streets, the sounds of the streets. And it feels in some ways so mammoth and so isolating. And so many times elevator banks are not working. So I think that's, you know, it's the poorest congressional district in America. It has quite a number of methadone clinics, which speaks to the sort of drug addiction that afflicts the area and the drug and alcohol use that permeates the area. There's certainly, you know, stagnation in jobs. I mean, there is some gentrification on the southern end of it. They're trying to gentrify it and to build the economy, but it's still a place where a lot of cops talk about it being kind of in a time warp, like 15 years behind the city or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are the things that you begin. Then as the stories went on, we learned more about how these housing projects can become organizing principles for young men, and young men who are often watched, you know, their parents engaged in the criminal justice system or got taken from them at some point and put into foster homes or some kind of public living arrangement, mental health, the transition from a public hospital, Lincoln Medical and Mental Health Center, back to the homes. Is there enough support when you return someone who's got a mental illness back to a mother who's struggling and impoverished or has health issues of her own and can't work? And then on the street, there are the crews that have formed. and almost as a matter of survival. I mean, so as each murder, as we covered each murder, yeah. our knowledge of it kind of built. And these are some of the factors that feed into it, I would say, why it might not be experiencing the same crime declines as other places.
Yeah. For you, when you show up for that very first story in Murder in the 4-0, and you don't have a strong background in this particular area, this particular precinct, this particular housing project, what do you do? Where do you start when you're reconstructing the first crime?
It's very emotional, number one. And as a general crime reporter, going back years and years, you know, I can still remember covering Flight 800 that crashed off of Long Island, and some of the things that stick with you are the way that they, you know, lined up the children's shoes that they found floating on the Atlantic Ocean, or the backpacks on a hangar in East Mauritius, on a Coast Guard hangar. So, but that spoke to the lives lost, and that was the souls that were gone, you know, so yeah. to speak. And so you just begin there. I mean, you begin with the human. When a homicide happened, and it happened 14 times during the year, yeah. we would all respond to the scene, me and my colleagues and a team of reporters, and you just begin to soak it up. But you're collecting information, and you're sort of using all your senses to gather everything you can about it, not for the next day's paper, not to try to make the best sense of it quickly,
right?
But for the long haul, and to sort of put in a mini time capsule. And in some ways, you don't know all the importance of everything you're seeing right away, but you just fill your notebook and we use our iPhones and take pictures, which is a great tool that we have.
How long, when you say that you're on the scene, how long after someone dies would you be there physically?
When they happened in the middle of the night, often my colleagues, Benjamin Mueller and Ashley Southall, would go. The one, Maribel Cavero Reyes, who died in the daytime, I happened to be actually in the precinct when that occurred. And so within hours, there's a service that monitors police radios, and they give out email notifications that are fed right from the police radios. And these are feeding through my smartphone 24/7. So the earliest indications are through that service, which is a live radio dispatch, someone calling for a bus, rush a bus, or mail shot, and they give the address. Very bare bones information,
yeah.
often inaccurate, honestly, but a very good red flag as to severity.
Yeah.
And then you make some phone calls in the middle of the night, which I did often, text or call the investigators that we had developed relationships with, or the fire department who might be sending the ambulance, or the police department's information office, and triangulate in the best you could on whether it was a fatality or likely to be fatal. And then it's just a matter of rushing to the scene. And, you know, again, like in any other reporting, you just keep your eyes open. You listen, you write down everything you see and hear, you take down people's names and phone numbers and addresses, you talk to everyone you can, you memorialize it all, and it becomes like a foundation on which to stand for the further reporting. The further reporting then is supplemented by our conversations with investigators over the coming days. What happened? Who was the person? Is there an arrest? What was driving it? Is there a motive or several motives?
Yeah.
And those things begin to give you places where you can dig much deeper. Ben Mueller would often go into the court files, and once we had a victim's name, we would find everything on the public record about that person. And we could also find their address, and we could find their relatives. And then you go around and knock on doors, and over time you build information. You build lots of information from several fronts. And that was the real gift of this project, and why it was so fulfilling, because we really felt like we could follow each thing as far as we possibly could till we were satisfied and that we really understood it emotionally and factually, obviously, and policy-wise, and what it meant, and just how it fit into the story of murder in New York in a safe age.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here for a quick word from our sponsor, Squarespace. Whatever your next big idea might be, you can count on Squarespace to help you out with putting it on the internet. Whether it's a portfolio or a store to sell your products, Squarespace has everything you need, including incredible templates, a drag-and-drop interface where you can make a beautiful website with nothing more than amounts, and great customer service if you run into any snags. The best part is you get a free unique domain. You know, sometimes you go to someone's website and it's like not a unique domain. It's like some weird long string. Not with Squarespace. You'll get the domain that you want, and this comes when you sign up. That's right. So you make your next move. You go to squarespace.com. You enter code LONGFORM. You'll get 10% off your first purchase. You'll get the free unique domain, and you'll be supporting the show. Again, squarespace.com, code LONGFORM. Start getting that idea into the world today. Thank you, Squarespace. Here I am back with Al Baker.
When you're going through that, and generally when reporting alongside an investigation, it sounds like a lot of what you're doing is similar to what the police are doing in trying to reconstruct the crime. What is the relationship between a reporter and the police like in the days after a murder like this?
It definitely evolved. One of my first editors, Kevin Flynn, was now a culture editor at the New York Times. He would always say we were like detectives with a pen, you know. There are a lot of similarities in our efforts. We're both sort of investigators of a type. We don't have subpoena power, although the detectives would often say that that helped us because certainly I think we got a lot further than they did in many cases with the relatives of victims and even people in the circles of a suspect's life. So I think in the beginning it was difficult. I mean, if there was a common theme in this series one theme I would identify is silence. Yeah. You know, there was a sub headline once written, Seas of Silence. And, you know, that one stuck with me. And it shot through, you know, victims' families, and it shot through the people on the perimeters of deadly encounters, and it shot through the police. It's not something that they're accustomed to having people paying attention to their work so closely, and it took time to build trust and to get them to tell more and more. And what was interesting about the organic nature of it also was that we would write a story and then we would go back to them. Let's do this again.
Yeah.
And so we went to a journalism class once, and they asked very good questions. And one question they asked was, you know, how do you maintain sources in the police department, and how do you maintain a sense of integrity and responsibility with other sources, with civilians and people and families who've suffered from the death of a loved one or their friends? And, you know, the clearest way to do that is really the power of the writing. I mean, when we did these stories, we would have, you know, 14, 15, 16-inch piles of paper from the notes, the transcribing the notebooks and the court files and the public documents or the Facebook postings or the feeds from victims who lived in Mexico to trace the arc of their life back to a home country if it was an immigrant victim, as it was in the case of Roberto Rodriguez and Nadia Saavedra. And for Maribel Cavera-Reyes, it was Ecuador. So we had stringers who went to their homes, and we saw the impact of a death in the Bronx to a place across the world.
Right.
And those piles of papers, from that you have to write a newspaper story. And we had the great blessing of our editors and the newspaper itself to write long. And even then, it was difficult. Even, you know, we found like we could have written double the amount for every story, at least in our minds, you know. So the responsibility of taking weeks of investigations and distilling it into a meaningful form that people could understand or find meaning in is a rigorous and necessary process. And in doing that, that helped gain respect with the police. You know, the police often looked at the stories and said, gee, you know, you went to Mexico and found wedding pictures of Nadia walking through the hills of Mexico in her white dress with her family and put that in the paper. My gosh, like we that's outside the scope of our aim to make an arrest and close a case. And yet they were touched by it. And even when we wrote some hard truths, you know, they respected it because it was truthful and it was explained in a way that made sense to them. And so I felt that with each story, that was the testament of our dignity, of our integrity, of our careful journalism. And so as time went on, the police came to see and understand exactly what we were doing, because in the beginning, I don't think they believed when we said we're going to write every murder. I don't think they believed it until they saw it. And they didn't even believe it in the first couple of times. It almost took through halfway through the year to really say, oh, wow, they really are writing every story, and they're writing them at 3,000, 4,000 words. I mean, all of that in the mix built over time and allowed us to work closer together and to understand these things more deeply as we went.
Is talking to a reporter the same as talking to the police for people in an investigation? How do you tell people that what you're doing is different than a police investigator? Well, or is it different than a police investigator?
No, it's quite different.
Yeah.
Yeah, much, much different. I mean, we did some things that, you know, for me, who's been a reporter for many, many years, I feel like I can say, speaking for myself, that I feel like we broke new ground in the landscape of American or New York City journalism in some of the things that we accomplished here. And they're beautifully expressed in these stories, in my view. But, you know, we talked with people who were in crews and gangs. Yeah. That's a far different proposition than talking with an investigator. And in fact, in one case, I don't want to get too specific, but it took us a long, long time to get people to speak with us. And it wasn't until our photographer, Angel Franco, happened to see the same people on the street. And being a great reporter with a camera that he is, he got into a conversation and came to learn that that's when they believed that we were reporters. They thought we were federal agents or something, not New York City police, because we were in plain clothes, but they thought, you know, they had us pinned for federal investigators, ATF, FBI or something, or U.S. attorneys or whatever. But then, you know, with Angel's blessing, then that allowed a whole nother layer of reporting for us and conversation. So I think that this is a stew of an issue in terms of people are making daily and moment-to-moment calculations in the South Bronx that we saw around murders about their own personal safety. And part of the calculation is whether this force that they're viewing can protect them. And they saw many times, you know, when there's a murder in a public housing high-rise, there's a body on the floor, Jessica White, in a playground on a hot summer night. Her children saw it. Her body fell by a bench, by a slide. You look up and there's hundreds of windows representing potentially thousands of eyes looking down on that like a fishbowl. And the measures by which people living, as I said, in poverty and in these, you know, moms take their kids home from school and lock the door and don't come out till the sun rises. But they're seeing it through the window and they can see that it's a scarcity of response. And then they measure that against the police shooting that happened in February when there were three helicopters in the air and spotlights shining down on them all night and hundreds of officers with heavy armor going door to door to door to door to find out who shot a police officer. They can see the difference between a civilian death and an officer death. That's just one example.
Yeah.
And you know, in some ways, it's not that they are angry, but that they worry that their life will be more in jeopardy if they cooperate because of all the other forces and gangs and crews and drug operations and crime that are there that they live with every day, and this army of this small force of people that they wonder or know can't protect them. And you add to that other things like historical measures, where inside those homes there's talk of the past 12, 13 years of a very draconian sort of zero tolerance policing. In 2012, there were, you know, 17,900 stops of people in the 40th precinct, one of the highest levels of stop and frisk in the stop and frisk era of New York City, which was remarkable because there was lower crime across the city, and yet stop and frisk, the number of times police officers stopped people to interrogate them and put their hands on them in about half the cases to frisk them, was remarkable. And here it was one of the highest levels of that policy. And 17,900, now 15,500 of those people walked away without any summons or any crime or any weapon being found. They were completely innocent, and they were mostly young people, mostly people of color, black and brown men. And that was a policy that has lasting implications, you know, ramifications in families, in people's experiences. And even if the city is now trying to turn it on a dime and reform it and fix it with special programs like neighborhood coordinating officers, that's another experience. Then they look down the Alexander Avenue to this precinct house built 90 years ago, and they see the degree of scandal that has occurred there in terms of, in 2011, there was a ticket-fixing scandal across the Bronx in which this involved officers fixing tickets for their friends, making tickets disappear. And the punishments for those tickets were still being doled out last summer. And it's also a place where one of the few publicly known places that was reprimanded for downgrading crime, which is misclassifying crime, pushing it to a lower category to make it appear that it's safer.
Yeah.
And Lorenzo Johnson, the commanding officer of the 40th Precinct, was bounced from the 4-0, and lots of people were reprimanded, and Commissioner Bratton went there and said, you can't mess with the integrity of our number system, and made a big public showing of a corrupt action here. So, you know, it's also the place with one of the highest levels of civilian complaint review board complaints by citizens. It's one of the highest levels of civilian lawsuits against the police. So it's churning with a history of both corruption and wrongdoing and mistreatment and policies that are now changed. And then into that, you know, when it comes to the very personal, intimate experience, a body falls. And this is part of the purpose of our project too. What, you know, a body falls, man, so-called man kills man, human kills human. In that most intimate moment, this is where some of these long-time grievances find a steam valve. And for one reason or another, there's no speaking coming forward. And the detectives, the investigators, they need people to speak to make the cases. When Jessica White died, when she was shot, a man seen on a video coming down the elevator, walking across the courtyard sidewalk, shoots, runs, shooting for someone else, and she gets hit by the bullet. And for her mother, it was the third person in the family to die in that same tiny little spot in the public housing complex. So the magnitude of loss for that woman is unbearable. And for her to look out the window and see, you know, a lone crime scene tape blowing in the breeze, as we wrote, is disheartening, and everyone can see that. And so some of the resource issues definitely play into it. Some of the feeling that, you know, other people we interviewed, when they call police for help, they wind up in handcuffs for some prior minor violation.
Yeah.
There's a lot of immigrants in the community who have certain feelings about getting involved with the police, suspecting the police. So it's quite an issue.
Your father was a police officer.
Yes.
How does that play into when you're dealing with a police officer? You have a full lifetime of history knowing people who do police work. What was your relationship with your father like around his work as an officer?
It was quite amazing. It must have been, choke me up here. It must have been very difficult for my dad because he had a very fortunate career. He was a lieutenant in the emergency service unit, which is a sort of an elite unit. I mean, he was very devoted to his fellow officers, I think. He knew that cops don't get sent out there with the tools to survive, whether they be verbal or tactical or even equipment. And I think he spent a lot of his time trying to work on that stuff. He was very fortunate. There were many times where he should probably, by all rights, been wounded or dead. You know, looking back on it as an adult, I think I can see more of what was in his eyes when he looked at me and my brother, which was maybe just how precious we were or some of the fear of what the world had out there. You know, I probably somehow absorbed that kind of care and love. And I think that he had a great influence in me in wanting to get the story right. He worked on overnight shifts. And I remember as a kid, I would look out the window and watch his taillights kind of disappear. I had a great sense of the danger he was in. And, you know, his taillights would go down the block. And the red of the, he had a little Volvo, old Volvo, like a 65 Volvo. And the taillights would kind of come back and then disappear in some trees. And I knew, like, the four brakes and then the last one. And then he made a turn. And I could hear the shift of the car, like, I can still hear it in my head. And then it would, as he got louder, as he shifted from first gear to second gear to third gear, and then it was gone. And I said, all right, I'll see, you know, we'll see if he comes back. And sometimes he came back with, remember he had some shotgun pellets in his cheek one time. He had been stabbed in the calf another time. And he would come in.
What area was he working in?
He worked mostly in Brooklyn. Yeah, he worked on Six Truck, which is attached to East New York, to the 75 precinct, which that was one area we looked at to cover in this story. But we thought that some of the narratives had been pretty well laid out. And also it was a little bit unmanageable in the sense that they had quite a lot more homicides.
Yeah. You have a, both in your writing and speaking to you, you have a poetic sensibility about these places and experiences. And one of the people I had on the show was one of your colleagues, Rukmini Kalamachi, who covers ISIS and terrorism for the New York Times. And she was previously a poet as a career. Yeah. And she talked about how when she starts thinking about a story, she thinks about it like a poem, like what are the indelible images that are going to open and close this story, and what am I going to sort of bookend this information with. You both cover pretty horrific stuff. Like, you both cover scenes that I assume are hard to get out of your mind afterwards. How do you draw a balance between the cold hard facts and something like a poetic description, or these, you know, more of a description of a place, when you're reporting one of these homicide stories?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really, I mean, I'm very encouraged about Rukmini and poetry. I mean, I love poetry, and there's, you know, as a reporter and having been at it for so long, there's sort of, I feel like, these journalists who are spirits in my mind. You know, I remember Mike McAlary was a columnist for the Daily News and wrote a lot about cops, wrote books about them, Good Cop, Bad Cop, yeah, about Michael Dow. And Warren Berry was an incredibly great mentor. And when I was a child, he was a soccer coach and a columnist at Newsday and the old New York Herald Tribune. And he wrote a lead one time. He worked at the New York Times as well. He was a Western correspondent, and he wrote a lead of a story from Idaho. The lead said, the locals call it buckshot rain. And then he just went on to describe it. And so I feel fortunate that I've had, you know, Joe Sexton was the Metro editor for many years and loves Seamus Heaney, you know, and often would send individual reporters some of his poems and things. And it definitely is a mix. It has to be the right balance. It can't be pure emotion. I often feel like sometimes I am too emotional as a reporter. And I have to kind of try to understand that and know that about myself. It's something about me that I adore, like that I cherish. You know, I love to feel. It's part of the human condition, whatever the feeling is. I mean, you just go through it. But you also, you know, mix it with the truth, with facts. And I think they're equal parts. I mean, it's a balance. It's hard to... The details have to have meaning in the facts of the story. There can't be, you can't use the poetry and the emotion without reason. First of all, you're limited by space. They have to kind of do a job to keep the story moving. You can't lose people in a newspaper story. You have to, they can't find themselves wondering, why am I reading this?
Right.
So you just tether them to the realities that you're writing about. And in some ways, you don't have to work too hard, I think, because we're all human. We all feel, and overly done, overly emotional is not very good. I may speak overly emotional at times, and I apologize for that. But I think also, you know, a collaborative nature. I mean, you know, great, smart, amazing people at the New York Times, both colleagues and editors, think a lot about these things, and you know, we benefited from that incredibly. You know, Ben Mueller and I would sit in a room and hammer out a lead, and then go home, and he'd rewrite it, and I'd rewrite it, and then we'd put that one together, and he may curb some of my emotional tendencies, and I may add some historical police things from ancient times that he hadn't yet unearthed in the clips, though he did unearth quite a lot. And so I think the blessing and benefit of great colleagues, and feeling very fortunate to be on that team, that definitely helps. It helps to talk about writing. It helps to discuss it first. I mean, there were many nights where we would be at a scene and, you know, your first impressions, we would be there late at night and we'd talk about, like, who was Freddie? You know, Freddie Collazo, like, why did he want to be in the forest houses? What brought him back?
Yeah.
And we would just talk about it. He wanted to be home. You know, that's what his friends told us. Or why did he leave? And what was the draw? And what were the forces in his life? One really trying to make it and going to school and yet still, you know, somehow couldn't get out of these entanglements and these complicated things that, you know, were in the background of his life that came back to get him. And, you know, we would spend hours, days, you know, interviewing people on the street and find ourselves, you know, up on, you know, 151st Street in Cortland or whatever, sitting in the car in the dark, you know, near midnight or whatever, and just start talking about what's important and what details matter.
Many of the people who committed among these 14 murders are also people who very easily could have been murdered themselves, people who are involved in drugs and gangs. And I was struck when I was reading it that balance that you're talking about in that limited space, you also need to tell two people's story in that space, often not one person's story. How did you treat balancing the victim and the perpetrator of the crime in these stories?
I'm glad to hear that you saw that. I feel encouraged by that because, you know, Kevin Biggie Thomas, who was one of the recent murders, we've yet to write three stories. Three murders occurred that we haven't yet published, and we're working on them. And one is Kevin Thomas, and he had been the victim of gunshots before, and he had shot people before. And so he was on, as the police would say, you know, both sides of the gun. And ultimately, he was killed on October 23rd, shot several times in the Mott Haven houses in the southern portion of the precinct. But I think that's exactly right. I mean, another theme that runs through these stories to me, and I could do a whole nother year on the children of the 4-0, is the children. There's got to be dozens of children abandoned by both dead parents and siblings and by imprisoned or on the run or what, you know, criminally affected perpetrators. So if you count the wreckage on both sides, there's quite a lot of just kids just in one year walking around the earth with these horrific memories. And Heaven Irizarry survived a knifing by her grandfather, who killed her grandmother right in front of her. The last thing her grandmother said was, was run. And she did, and she lived, and she was stabbed 5 times, but she had the courage to run upstairs to her her neighbor who had cared for her. And so the lives of the victims in many ways often are unexamined by the public entities, by the police. And so we felt a responsibility to tell their stories as well. And the premise of the project was, what forces are driving each person to that point? Many of the victims had criminal records, and many of the suspects had lives that were underserved, I think they would say, or failed. Feliz Volquez, who stabbed Miss Carmen Torres Gonzalez, the very first murder of the year, he had been someone with a history of schizophrenia who attacked a coworker in a Manhattan restaurant with a plate, and he was prosecuted for that, but neither the defense attorney or the prosecutors really raised mental illness, and then he had been treated several times. If you want to understand how it came to be that a woman caring for her mother in a public housing apartment came to be killed by a man who lived with his mother across the hall, you have to understand that man's life and the voices that he heard and how he targeted her. And that's an example of the poetry as well, and the details supporting the story, because Carmen's voice was a voice that this man heard, Mr. Feliz Volquez, and he was threatened by that voice because he'd heard other voices. And ultimately, like, her kindness and her speaking in this very narrow hallway to her mother's caregiver and sort of being in this common space, it was stunning because it was so close as to be a domestic killing and yet as much a stranger murder as you could ever imagine at the same time. But to understand that, you had to understand the perpetrator's background and history and what brought him there and the wreckage of the life that was created by his action.
Yeah.
It was equally important to me.
Do you have, like, ambitions to ever revisit these stories? I was just thinking the biggest echo, maybe it's the Bronx connections. I remember reading Random Family, Adrian LeBlanc's book, which traces a bunch of people living in the Bronx through about 2 decades of prison and children moving different houses. And, you know, it's a lot about the reverberation of how something that happened 20 years ago could lead to a completely different present. And in your stories, it seems like there's a lot of reverberations to the past, and then these actions are going to trigger many things down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a great question. For the New York Times and for our editors, Wendell Jameson and Henri Cavan, to let us do this, to give us this gift of long-form journalism. I mean, it's been, to me, probably the single most fulfilling thing I've done, despite all the sadness and emotion of it and the subject matter being quite heavy and hard. And that's another way that we connected with detectives, was just by sharing that humanity, you know, how they can absorb these things and move on. But it's hard to move on. I feel a great responsibility in some ways to write more, because I feel like there's a lot more that we know that we could say and we should say in some way. Now, whether that's now or later or something, I'm not sure. But it was very intense. It was a year of our lives to go through one thing. We were kind of untethered from daily obligations for the most part. There was a few things that happened during the year that we had to work on. You know, Commissioner Bratton resigned or left the police department, and there was a terrorist attack in Manhattan. But it's hard to turn the corner and leave all of this. So somewhere up the line, maybe we'll find a way to write more about it.
Yeah.
And we're certainly following things. We're following the police response and the city's response and the 3 murders, but we're also keeping our eye on the resource issue and the deployment issue in the Bronx writ large, in the Bronx itself, yeah. Some of the disparities that we found.
Outside of this special project, when you're doing that daily crime beat, police beat reporting, how has that changed over the course of your career? I mean, how is the job different for someone coming in today than it was when you started doing this?
It's faster. It's smarter, I think. I think journalism, you know, has made great strides. There's, you know, in the old days you'd get, you know, I remember being at the Daily News and being a crime reporter, and we wore little beepers and the desk would beep you. And you had to find a working payphone, which could take 20 minutes. And then, you know, you'd be driving around and maybe you were hot on a lead of a, you know, person you wanted to interview, but you had to like go down a wider avenue, a more commercial stretch, and drive down it for a few miles till you found somebody who would let you into the back of their store, a dry cleaner or a bodega. You know, I remember many bodegas using their, can I use your phone, and calling the desk to get someone to tell you a new direction or a reporting goal or something, or new information that came from City Hall. And there was just this much slower, and everything was for the next day, you know. Right. And so I think there's a nostalgia or whatever, but I think in many ways, you know, you look at that stuff and you could shudder actually at some of what was written and things. I think the writing is clearer, and now it's more nimble, it's quicker, in some ways it's smarter. The smartphones, you know, I mentioned Mike McAlary. I remember being with him at the Murrah Building bombing in Oklahoma City, and he was able to find out the current reading of the number of dead from the bombing of the federal building by Timothy McVeigh. And I was like, how did you do that? And he was on the internet. This was 1994. He's like, this is the internet. And do you know about this? And I was like, not really. He's like, this makes you smarter. I was like, oh. And I'll never forget that. And I think that it does make us smarter. There, you can certainly find things. And I think social media is great historically. Just as a tool for history, people are always posting things that say, oh, you think this is the first time you've heard something like this? Well, look here, in 1950 or 1970, this happened, and here's a lesson for us today. Don't think that we've not been through an issue before, you know, or so I think it, us being more connected digitally and things, has great hope for the news.
Do you see a difference? I had on this program Cy Hirsch, who worked as a police reporter in Chicago in the 50s. And he described the relationship between journalists and the police then as, he was like, look, journalism was mostly a working class profession. The same kind of people became journalists as became cops. There was like a lot of, you know, a lot of drinking shared between the two of them. And then he described meeting kids who want to be journalists today. And, you know, it's a job that's heavily full of people who can afford to spend a year at an unpaid internship, or who can afford to go to journalism school, et cetera. Has the demographic of people who do this job changed, in your opinion?
I think perhaps there's some truth in that. I definitely think that some of the great traditions of journal, I agree that it was a blue-collar kind of a craft. I mean, even from the way the paper, I mean, there was hot lead and, you know, they called it the wood, the front page, because it was literally like when the letters had it was more of like building a fence than anything in some ways, the pressmen and the way that, the even that word. Journalism is of the people. I mean, its greatest tradition. I mean, it's a cornerstone to the democracy. An informed electorate needs to be informed, and so for it to reach the greatest numbers of people, it has to be of the people. The people who write it and report it and produce it must be a broad panoply of American experience. And I, you know, it's interesting. It's you know, just between the police and reporters, I feel like in New York City, there was a great tradition of reporters talking with police and having a lot of interaction with cops. And I think some of that has sadly gone away as a tradition again. And I don't know if that's a reflection of the reporting staffs or if it's a reflection of the way that policing has become much more careful. I often think that the police are too careful. I mean, one of the breathtaking things about this was that they let the men and women of the New York Police Department, you know, they spoke with us, and we developed our own depths of trust, and I had quite deep connection to them for all these murders. And I don't think the police understand the, well, they understand it, but they don't let the quality of their human beings come out as much as they should. I mean, some of the greatest stories they have are in the lives and work of the people in the department, and they ought to let more of them talk more freely. I guess that's kind of a bold thing to say, but the notion of controlling or spinning from public entities, and particularly the police, is not, I think it's self-defeating in some ways for them.
Do you maintain a lot of police contacts? I mean, is your phone full of police officers? I mean, after doing for this so long, you must have met a good portion of the NYPD over time.
I have. I do. And I've known them for so long that sometimes I can have conversations that are also emotional in terms of, you know, John Timoney died last year, and he was someone I knew and covered, and certainly an incredibly inspiring figure within policing circles. You know, you asked about my dad, and I think part of being the son of a cop made me understand that police are human, and certainly having grown up with a father who was a policeman, I saw the toll it took on him, and, you know, watched him come home and put his gun in a little steel box that he had bolted to the ceiling of our laundry room, and he painted it bright red, and there was a lock on it, and it's the first thing he did. He came home, took his gun off, put it in the box, locked it, you know, and I saw cars come to get him. Speeding state troopers came to our house and took him away for heavy jobs that he was being called to go into. And just watched his, you know, and he also told stories to my friends. My friends would always say, tell a story. And he'd tell the story about the dog on a board on a middle of a six-story building with no windows. German Shepherd just walking back and forth on this plank of wood that I guess a painter would use or whatever, but how did the dog get there? And the time a monkey threw one of his partners, a lady had a monkey in Brooklyn, and it threw his partner around, and I think it ended his career. And these were some animal stories that were the children of the neighborhood found interesting. And then there were sadder ones as well. You know, time he went down an elevator shaft to save a troubled child, teenager, and got stuck in the shaft with the kid, and the kid, like, beat him up and pulled his hair out, and, you know, my dad just had to hold on to him until they could break the wall and get him out. And so I have all this sort of experience, thankfully, through the generosity of my father and his life, to inform me about policing. And yet, at the same time, I often feel I worry that I'm too close to it. You know, I had a poster in our basement my brother and I used to use as a backstop for pitching. We'd play, like, wiffle ball in the basement, and it was the target for the police range, the figure that the police shoot at to test their efficiency with shooting. And that was in my basement my whole life.
Yeah.
And a colleague of mine, Michael Wilson, went to the range one day, and he saw that thing, and he's like, what's that? And he wrote a story about it that was incredible. And it turns out it was called The Thug. And he explored some themes in that story that were so true, because he said that he wanted to find the model for the target. It was a man standing there with a gun and you shot at him to qualify for your weapon. And he wrote in the story how everybody thought it looked like everyone. It was sort of a generic look of a white male in the 1960s and 70s with the mutton chop sideburns and stuff. Yeah. But me and my brother said it was my dad. We said, that looks like you. So the things he found in the story were... So, I think I worry at times that I need fresh eyes, or I'm close to things, and I have to always remind myself, is that new, or am I seeing this correctly? And I think that helps me in some ways, or I'll talk to people about it.
It's a very real question. You had talked earlier about, you know, the pre-internet tips and tricks, which is something that takes many years to build up that kind of a knowledge. But I've also talked to people who on the show who do things like war reporting and say, like, you know, don't do it after 40. You got to stop at a certain point. It's both addictive and it, like, changes your perspective on what it is. What do you want to do from here? What's next for you?
Oh, Well, I want to keep writing and keep, you know, expanding law enforcement coverage.
Yeah.
And maybe think about revisiting this. And I want to write more long form things because I really enjoyed this process. You know, the world is everywhere. When I was a younger reporter, I had a goal to be a foreign correspondent, and my life worked out in a way that I haven't yet made that decision. But my wife said to me, you know, you did want to see places in the world that were in extreme duress and suffering, and you talk about, you know, feeling like you have the strength, really, and the understanding of the responsibility to cover things that are quite grave, and to try to, as best you can, to make a contribution to our world by shining light on it. You know, that's what you've decided to do, and that's what you've always aspired to. And, you know, it's funny that at this point in your life, I'm 49 years old, and she's like, you know, it's sort of, you found kind of like that situation right here in New York, in a way. And I think in many ways that's true. I mean, the world is everywhere. It's right here where we're sitting. It's the corner outside the building. It's the Bronx. It's a foreign country. You know, there's a lot of commonality in humanity, and obviously. And so I just, whatever I do, I want to bring the greatest level of respect and hard work ethic and a search for truth that I can.
Well, thank you very much for this interview. This was very interesting.
Thank you.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to Al Baker for coming in. Thanks to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to our intern, Courtney Harrell. Thank you to our sponsors, MailChimp and Squarespace. Again, that's squarespace.com. Offer code LONGFORM, 10% off and a free domain name. Thanks, Squarespace. We will be back here next week. If you want to help the show out, hey, maybe rate us on iTunes. That helps it go up the charts and helps more people find out about it. Okay, thank you. We'll be back.